Great. Good morning. We had homework due today. Please hand it in. Are there any questions? Yes.
I have a question about the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah?
The 2x2.
Yeah?
No, actually the 3x3.
Yeah?
That sheet you gave us,
we yes.
put down the possible permutations using a top, left, and
right. Yes.
And they all described the permutation by three groups of four.
With 3-4 cycles, yes.
So those are all odd permutations, right?
They.
Because you have.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you should be able to have permutations that are even yes. more odd, depending on
yes.
how many.
Yes. 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 Yes.
So can you use that rule about odd and even?
No, because these are all permutations which you actually can do, right? So you can still do. No, you can't. It's in some way a similar argument, but you need to talk about other permutations. It's not exactly the even and odd. It's a very similar idea, but it's somewhat different. Also, the issue with even and odd gives you a factor of 2. Basically, you have a factor of 3 here because you can't turn one cornerstone a third. So it's the idea is the same, but the technical details would have to go somewhat different. Yeah. Yeah?
I don't understand the notation here.
Okay, so G is a permutation, and the image of N, the point N under G, is I. Or if you want, so which number was 76? 72. So we have the image of N under G is I, or if you want, you could write G of N is equal to I. That means the same.
Oh.
And we'll see probably on Friday one reason why I prefer, why one might want to prefer this exponentiation notation, but it really means the same. Yeah, since one of you actually wrote me an email and said, a 6x6x6 Rubik's Cube now is available. The problem is basically an engineering problem. If you look at what happens when you turn the cube about halfway like this, if you have a split into 6, your cornerstone will be completely off this face. So the mechanism which they use to build them, if you take, I mean, the 2x2x2 is slightly different, but the 3x3x3 and 4x4x4, 5x5x5, they are mechanically basically the same idea. But that mechanism will not work for 6x6x6 because this stone stands off and it wouldn't hold here. It would fall apart. So that's the difficulty there. And indeed, apparently someone figured another way out of doing it, but it must be a far more complicated mechanism of putting it together. It doesn't really have anything to do with the course. I just put the problem in because some of you are engineers, and in some way I thought this is an engineering problem one can ask at this point. Other questions? Yeah? Yeah? Yeah?
When I was, when you call it the subgroup, I remember that if it's a cyclic group, every subgroup is also cyclic, but if it's a cyclic subgroup, it doesn't necessarily make the group cyclic?
No, no.
Okay, that's still helpful.
No. It doesn't. And that's basically a way of answering. So to get give an example of a cyclic subgroup, you just pick some element in there, and you can pick whatever you want. If you say you take the subgroup generated by this element, this is automatically a cyclic subgroup, and you don't need to do anything else. Okay, now if you take the theorem that a subgroup of a cyclic group is cyclic, which we actually, I don't think we've proven this here. It's often in the books. This is something which holds. It's not horribly hard to prove. One can prove it somehow similar to the, was it the first problem on, no, the first problem on the homework, the previous homework, not this homework, but the previous homework. One can use similar ideas where you, to show this. Anyhow, then, if the group is cyclic, every subgroup would be cyclic. So if you take the contrapositive of this, this means that if there is a non-cyclic subgroup, the whole group cannot be cyclic. So, okay, so if I ask you to give me an example of a subgroup which is not cyclic, if there is one at all, the whole group will be one. Yeah, so you could just give me, in that problem, for an example of a non-cyclic subgroup, you could give me the whole group. Okay, how would you verify that it is not cyclic? There you basically would have to go through the elements and to show that the cyclic subgroup, that for each of the elements, the cyclic subgroup generated by that element is not the whole group. Would not be the group.
So we could use the whole group as a subgroup?
Yeah, the whole group is a subgroup of itself, sure. Like a whole ring is a subring of itself or an ideal of itself. Yes.
I wasn't sure if it was okay to...
No. And unless it says explicitly a proper subgroup, or we exclude that case, no, then it is, this is, in general in mathematics, the degenerate cases often are in there, unless it explicitly says, no, we do not consider it. And that's often actually a useful technique when there is a new definition or so, to start looking at what are the extreme cases, what are, because these are often the easiest to understand. Yeah?
So if you want to generate, for that problem, you want to generate something that's a non-cyclic.
Yeah?
You could pick any two elements in it, and
if you pick two arbitrary elements, it's still possible that the group would be cyclic. Look at the integers modulo 6. This is cyclic, namely generated by 1. But if you take the subgroup generated by 2 and 3, it's the whole group. So just the fact that you give me two generators for it does not necessarily mean that someone might be able to just find one generator which generates it. So to show explicitly that a group is not cyclic, one basically would have to go through all elements and look at the subgroup generated by the elements. Or what you can do is, it's not hard to see if you look, is to look at orders. It's not hard to see that if you have a cyclic subgroup, the order of the subgroup is exactly the order of the element. I think we've even shown this at some point. So if you know that your whole group has more elements than the order of any of the elements, the whole group can't be cyclic. So that's an easier way of showing it. But just because you give two elements is not enough, yeah?
Can you say that order part again?
Okay. If you have a cyclic group generated by some element A, the order of this group is the same as the order of A. Right? And order for a subgroup is the number of elements. So if you have a subgroup or some group and you know the element orders of the elements in there, and you know the elements all have order 2, 3, or 5, and 1, but your group has 20 elements. Well, let's say 60 elements. The group can't be cyclic, because if it's cyclic, it would have to have an element of order 60.
The subgroup,
yeah. If it has 60 elements and it's if it has k element and it's cyclic, it must have an element of order k. And one can even calculate that how many it has to have, but that's basically going into number theory. Other questions? No? Okay. So what we did last time, we defined cosets in groups. They are defined exactly the same concept as in rings. So if we have H is a subgroup of G, we have a coset are of the form H times G, which are the sets of all products H times G, where H lies in H. And technically these are right cosets because I have the representative on the right. One can similarly define left cosets, but I won't be doing this here in the course. Okay. And we had noted the cosets lying in the same coset is an equivalence relation. The cosets form a partition of the group. So the cosets of H form a partition of the group G. And that's exactly the same as with rings. One thing which is new, and this has more to do with the examples. With rings, typically our examples were infinite. And if we have infinite, it doesn't really make sense so much to talk about number of elements. Yes, it's infinity, but compare numbers of elements. But in groups, often the examples are finite. And therefore, it makes sense to look at the number of elements. Okay, so let's remark that the number of elements in H is the same as the number of elements in any coset H times G. Why is this the case? Because the elements of H times G just are parametrized by the elements of H, right? You just take all the elements and multiply each of them with G, and multiplication by a group element is 1-to-1 because the group element has an inverse. So clearly the subgroup has exactly as many elements as the coset, as any coset. On the other hand, the cosets form a partition of the group. So we split the whole group into chunks where all the chunks have the same size. Well, but that means the size of each chunk must divide the order of the group. And that's a very important theorem. So let me state this. This is Lagrange's theorem. Let's suppose G is a group. Let's suppose it is finite. It has finitely many elements. And let's suppose H is a subgroup of G, then the order of H divides the order of G, and the quotient, the order of G divided by the order of H, is the number of cosets of H in G. Okay, and because of this, we define the following. We use the following definition. The index of H in G, and we write a symbol which looks a bit like division. We write G colon H in square brackets, which just means the index of H in G is the number of cosets. Cosets of H in G. So in particular, so this theorem now is basically saying the index of H in G is simply the order of G divided by the order of H. And that's in some way the justification for this notation, which looks like a division. Okay. Yeah, why is this the case? The cosets of H form a partition of G. The cosets of H form a partition of G. So we have G consists of H, disjoint union with some coset HG1, disjoint union with a coset HG2, disjoint union and so forth, till finally some coset G index of H in G, where these, where the identity, oh sorry, I need here, I start with was, I have zero, so I need to do minus one. H, the identity, G1, G2 up to G index minus one are representatives for the cosets. Okay, so the cosets form a partition, and that's just because they are an equivalence. They are equivalence classes, and we've shown that equivalence classes form a partition. Okay, but if we have a partition, we can count the magnitude, the size, the number of elements by just adding up the number of elements in each of the parts. We don't have to worry about inclusion, exclusion, or multiple counting because they form a partition. The intersection of any of these is empty. So, because it is a partition, we know that the number of elements in G is the number of elements in H plus the number of elements in H, G1 plus, and so forth. But what is this? What is the number of elements in H, G1? That's the same as the number of elements in H, because all cosets of H have the same number of elements as H has. So we get the order of H plus the order of H plus and so forth plus the order of H. Each of these cosets has exactly as many elements as the order of H. And how many summons do we have? Exactly as many summons as we have cosets, which we had defined as the index. So we have exactly as many summons as we have cosets, and therefore we get, this is the number of cosets times the or one of the summons, because they're all the same, and there we have this product. The order of G is the number of cosets times the order of H. Okay. Right. And this theorem, which actually now came very, the proof was very easy, is one of the most important theorems in group theory. First, there are some applications, and we will see some in a moment. More generally, it is the first theorem which gives somehow a connection between the structure of a group and its order. Divisibility conditions on the order tell us something about the structure of the group. If I have a group with 10 elements, I cannot have a subgroup of order 4, because 4 does not divide 10. So, and that is one theme which permeates finite group theory, the idea or the aim to describe structural properties for the group from arithmetic properties coming from the group order. And indeed, this is a very, very successful approach which lets one get quite a lot of information about groups. What I should just mention is that the converse of this is not true. The converse is false. What do I mean by converse? Here I'm saying if I have a subgroup, the order must divide the order of the group, but I don't necessarily have subgroups for all divisors. So if I take A4, the alternating group of order 4, has no subgroup of order 6, but the order of A4 is 12. So we can't have, this theorem tells us if there is a subgroup, the order must divide the order of the group, but it does not hold the other way around that for every divisor we get a subgroup. So if we have a group of order 12, for example, we don't necessarily have a subgroup of order 6. For certain devices, namely basically the prime powers, one can show that such subgroups exist. That is something which is called Sylow's theorem, but that's beyond what we will be doing in this course here. Okay, so what is this theorem of Lagrange's good for? And now we can actually get a whole sequence of corollaries. Suppose we have, so G is a finite group. Let's take an element in this group, then the order of this element divides the order of the group. That's something which I think I've stated already a couple of times, but I couldn't yet prove. Why is this the case? Let's just consider the cyclic subgroup. Consider H, which is the cyclic subgroup generated by this element little g. Then we know, that's what we've proven, the order of H is the same as the order of G. But the order of H divides the order of G, of the group G, because this is a subgroup of the group G. So the order of every element must divide the order of the group. If I have a group of order 16, I cannot have an element of order 5 in there. And if you look at all the examples of groups which we had, that is always the case. So, for example, if you look at rotational symmetries of a cube in space, let's not look at this as a puzzle, just as a rigid cube, one can calculate that there are 24 rotational symmetries of this cube in space. Why 24? Because one face can be rotated to any of the other faces, so that we have 6 faces. And when a face is fixed, we can still do 4 rotations, which keep the face fixed. So that gives us 24 possibilities. So we know any rotation of the cube can have an order at most, just something which divides 24. So we can't have an order 5 rotation of the cube. It's just not possible. Okay, so the order of an element must divide the order of the group. Okay. Right. Next, this will give us a statement that certain groups actually have to be cyclic. Namely, if we have a group of prime order. So, next corollary. Let's suppose the order of G of a group G is P, where P is a prime. Then G is cyclic. Why is this the case? Well, let's take an element in the group which is not the identity. Let an element which is not the identity in the group. Then the order of this element must divide P, must divide the prime P, because that's the order of the group. But if it's not the identity, the order is not 1, right? Is bigger than 1. So this means the order of this element is P, which is the same as the order of the group. But that means, if the order is this, this means that the cyclic subgroup generated by this element must be the whole group. So the whole group is cyclic, generated by this one element. So if we have, we know, if we have a group of order 5 or 7 or 11, such a group always must be cyclic. And that is a first step towards classifying groups. This is one of the aims of group theory, to be able to classify groups of a given order. If the order is a prime, we basically have solved the problem. We know these groups are cyclic groups. And for a cyclic group, we can easily write down a multiplication table. It's the same as the table for the integers modulo the prime. Okay. Right. Next corollary. Let's suppose we have an element little g in a group. And again, this group is finite. Then if I take this element and take it to the power order of the group, I get the identity. Well, why is this the case? It's the case because the order of the group of the element divides the order of the group. So the order of the group is a multiple of the order of this element. If I take the element, so the order of the group is some multiple A times the order of G. Therefore, G to the order of the group is equal to G to the A times order of G, which is G to the order of G to the power A. G to the order of G is the identity to the power A, and that is the identity. So, if we have a group, we take an element to the order of the group, we always get the identity. For example, if you take the symmetries of a square, we had calculated these, there are 8 symmetries, rotation and reflections of a square. Any of them, if you would repeat it 8 times, you always would be back at the origin. Actually, in this case, it's sufficient to repeat it 4 times, but that is not always the case. But here, in general, we know if we do it as often as the group has elements, this can be done. Right, and this, I think I mentioned this before, there is the issue if you have any kind of encryption system where the elements, the encryption operation actually would form a group. That is problematic now, because this would tell you if you would know the elements form a group, and that would tell you if you just iterate your operation often enough, and you don't even would know how often you need to do it at most, the order of the group, then you're back at the origin. Okay. Right, finally, the most famous corollary of them all, of these corollaries here, and this is called Fermat's little theorem. Fermat's big theorem, well, actually, at that point, it wasn't yet a theorem, is that a to the n plus b to the n equals c to the n does not have solutions in integers a, b, c, n if n is bigger than 2, and a times b times c is not equal to 0. So that is something completely beyond here. But on the other hand, this is something which Fermat actually proved. His proof was much harder than the proof we can give now. But let me first state the theorem. So let a be an integer and p be a prime. Then I claim that if I take a to the p, and I take this modulo p, this is congruent to a. Or I can just say a to the p is congruent to a modulo p. Okay. So, for example, let's pick a prime. Let's say we choose 7. Let's pick some number. Let's say we choose 3. I claim that 3 to the 7 modulo 7 is congruent to 3. That's what the theorem says. If you want to check it, 3 to the 3 squared is 9 modulo 7 is 2, right? So 3 to the 6, which is 3 squared cubed, is 2 cubed modulo 7, which is 1. So 3 to the 7, which is 3 to the 6 times 3, is 1 times 3 is 3. Okay. And it works in other cases. Indeed, what you see that the last multiplication actually is the multiplication from 1. So often this is written in the form, if P does not divide A, then A to the P minus 1 is congruent to 1 modulo P. And that is equivalent. Why is it equivalent? If P does not divide A, A is invertible modulo P, and then we can basically multiply with the inverse, take this identity and multiply with the inverse of A, then we get 1 here and we get A to the P minus 1. So this is an equivalent statement. So the only reason I wrote it this way is that here we don't need to look at this condition, does P divide A or not. So let's give a proof of this.
Can you say again what your notation is?
It's often written as often people use the line, use a vertical line for divides. P does not divide. And then the slash through is not. Yes, we certainly have that P is a prime. That's, if P is not a prime, this is not true. Basically, if P is not a prime, we would need to change this exponent here to something which is called the Euler phi function. But we haven't done this. If you're interested in that, take Math 405 next semester, which is about number theory, where they will do these things. Okay. Right. So let's prove this. And the if P divides A, then I have that A is congruent to 0 modulo P. And then obviously I have that A to the P is congruent to 0 to the P, which is congruent to 0 modulo P. And then it is clearly true. Then I just have zeros on both sides. That's the uninteresting part. So now let's assume that P does not divide A. Well, and also without loss of generality, I want to consider A as a number which is smaller than P. The same thing holds if A is bigger than P, just then here this congruence basically will give me a number which is smaller. So when I work modulo P, I clearly can initially reduce modulo P, and I'm just doing this. So without loss of generality, let's assume that A is smaller than P. Well, if A is smaller than P, P does not divide it, and A is not zero, that means that A is an element of the group of units modulo P. Then A is an element of the units of the integers modulo P. Right? The multiplicative units modulo P. How many units are, this is a group? This is a group with how many elements, how many units modulo P do we have? Well, all the numbers from 1 to P, right? Because all of them are coprime. So this is a group with P minus 1 elements. Okay, so A is an element in a group which has P minus 1 elements. Okay, now let's use this fact here, right? So if I take A to the power order of the group, A to the P minus 1, and this P minus 1 is this. This is the number of elements in the group, is the identity element. If I do arithmetic in the group, in the units of the integers modulo P. But what is the arithmetic there? The arithmetic there is multiplication modulo P. This means that A to the P minus 1, and the identity is the number 1, is congruent to 1 modulo P. And now I just multiply both sides with A. Now I multiply both sides with A, and I get A to the P here, and I get A on the other side, and I'm done. So if P is a prime and A is an arbitrary integer, then I can, I know that A to the P minus 1 is congruent to 1, respectively. A to the P is congruent to A modulo P. Okay. And, this was a question. So, what is this theorem good for? Apart from that it looks somehow rather surprising that this condition holds. It is good, for example, if we wanted to test whether a number is prime. There are certain public key systems, you might have heard about them. There is one which is called RSA, which basically rely on finding big prime numbers. So you certainly want to be able, you need to be able to test that certain numbers are primes. Okay, how can you test that a number is a prime? Well, one way is, and that's probably the way you learned in school, you try whether you can factor it, right? But that's a rather tedious way, if your numbers are big. So let me give you an example. I hope these numbers are correct. Let's say, so example, let's look at the following number. N is 2 to the 257 minus 1. Is this prime? Okay, so N to the 257. 2 cubed is 8, 2 to the 4 is 60. So if I divide 257 by 4, which gives me about 64, this gives me roughly the number of digits. So this is a number which has roughly 64 digits. I want to know, is this prime? Okay. How would you go about factoring? This looks really horrible. I mean, something which we try out 2, 3, 5. This is not going to work. So how on earth can one try this? Well, what one can try is, let's assume that n is prime. Assume n is prime. Then, and now I pick, and I don't remember why I wrote, chose for A now the number 100. I think I just tried it out for this number 100. Then, for A equals 100, we must have that 100 to the n is congruent, or let's say 100 to the n minus 1, would have to be congruent to 1 modulo n. Okay. So that's what this theorem tells us. Okay, does this help us? Initially this looks, oh my God, instead of now having to factor this number, I have to take this power. I certainly don't want to multiply 100 that many times with itself. But I don't need to do this. For example, if I wanted to calculate 100 to the 8, how could I calculate it? I first calculate 100 square, then I calculate 100 squared again, which is 100 to the 4, and then I square it again, right? So I can calculate 100 to the 8 in 3 multiplications, which is the logarithm of 8 to the base is 2, instead of 8 multiplications. And the same thing works for bigger powers. So if I want the, say, 65,536, which is 2 to the 16th power of 100, I don't need to do that 65,000 something multiplications, I just need to do 16 multiplications, right? Because I can do this repeated squaring trick. Okay, what about a number? This is not a pure power of 2, right? But if I want, let's say I wanted the, let's say, 11th power of some number, A. How can I use this trick? Well, 11 is 8 plus 2 plus 1, right? So to calculate the 8th power, I anyhow calculate the 2nd power on the way. So what I can do is, I can remember the 2nd power and then multiply 8 cubed, which I can do by the repeated squaring, multiply with 8 squared, which I had on the way, and multiply with 8, not with 8, sorry, not with 8, with 100, which I had anyhow. So, using this trick, repeated squaring, what I can basically do, I take this big number, I write it in binary form, that tells me which powers of 2 I need to express this. And then I just square my number repeatedly, and I always reduce modulo n. Immediately on the way. So I never have to deal with numbers which are bigger than n. I do this repeated squaring trick, and then I basically just have to do as many multiplications, I have to do twice the binary logarithm of that number, many multiplications modulo that number. And that is something which actually is not that hard to do. Well, this is still a little bit bigger than to do by hand, so I will just give you a toy example with smaller numbers. But that is really, this is something which on a calculator it's not hard to do. On a calculator you can do this very quickly. Just, probably you need something which can represent sufficiently, which can work with numbers with 64 digits. What I'll show you now with numbers is a smaller toy example, but it's exactly the same idea. So let's pick a number. Let's say we pick, so toy example. Let's say we choose n is 35, which is 5. Well, yes, we know it's 5 times 7, but again, it's a toy example. It's to be smaller. And I choose, let's say, a equals 2. Let's try this. Right. Now I write 35 in binary form. 35 in base 2. Is equal to, or well, let's just write it out. 35 is 32 plus 2 plus 1, right? That's 35 written as a sum of powers of 2. So to calculate 2 to the, now I need to calculate, to calculate 2 to the 35 modulo 35. How am I doing this? I calculate 2. So what is my power? For the power 1, I get 2. For the power 2, I get 4. For the power, now I square again. So if I get power 4, that gives me 8. No, that gives me 16. Power, I square again. Yeah, 4 gives me 16. 8 gives me 16 squared. Is 256. But now I'm calculating modulo 35, right? So I get 256 modulo 35. What do I get there? 7 times 30 is 210. So 7 times 35 is 245, right? So 245 is a multiple of 35. So 256 is 11 more than this. So I should get 11 here. Right? Okay. The 16th power is 11 square modulo 35. 11 square is 121 modulo 35. 3 times 35. 3 times 30 is 90, 3 times 5 is 15, so 3 times 35 is 105, 121 is 16 more than 105, so this is 60, right? And finally, power 32. That is, sorry, what? Yeah, sorry, 32. Now I need again to calculate 16 square, but I've done this already before, right? So 16 square will again give me 11. Okay, so now 2 to the 35 is congruent to 2 to the 32 times 2 squared. Times 2, and I want to do the whole thing modulo 35. Well, now I know what this is. 2 to the 32 is 11. 2 squared is 4. 2 is 2. Modulo 35. So I reduce modulo intermediately. Right, what is this? 11 times 4 is 44. 44 modulo 35 is 9, right? So this is congruent to 9 times 2, which is congruent to 18 modulo 35. But if 35 was prime, this power would have to be 2, right? That's what the theorem would told us. 2 to the 35 would be congruent to 2 modulo 35. But I got 18 here. 18 is not 2. So 35 cannot be prime. Because otherwise I would have a contradiction to this theorem. Yeah? Is this argument clear? And the same argument you can do with bigger numbers, with much bigger numbers. And basically to calculate this power, what you could do, for example, in gap, there is a command power mod. You can do power mod 100 comma n minus 1 comma n. So this calculates the n minus 1 power of 100 modulo n exactly using this trick with the binary decomposition of the exponent and repeated squaring. Yes?
Why did you have your powers go up by factor of 2? Why didn't you do like 3 or 5?
Because this reduces the number of multiplications I have to do, right? I want to do, to get the power 35 in as few multiplications as I can. And that's why I'm always, I risk, and I can square, and that always doubles it. So that's what I'm doing here, right? So instead of doing 35 multiplications, I only had to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, and now multiply them together, 6, 7 multiplications. So basically, you get asymptotically twice the binary logarithm of the number. In this case, yes, 7 versus 35 doesn't look that enormously. If your number is that big, you have about, here you have, well, the binary logarithm of this number is 256. So you have about 512 multiplications there versus a number with 64 digits, many more than 64 because this was a bad estimate, probably a number with about 100 digits multiplications. That's where it's enormously saving there. And that's why I can do this very quickly. So this is a test. It's a necessary condition for a number being prime. It is not sufficient. So a number which fulfills this test is called a pseudo-prime for base A. Unfortunately, there are numbers which fulfill this test for any basis and still are not prime. Such numbers are called Carmichael numbers. So this is not a proof that a number is prime, but it can be used very easily to disprove that a number is prime. To show that a number is not prime. Right. Thank you very much, and I see you on Friday.